Calling to order this meeting of Joint Committee on Ways and Means Subcommittee on Human Services. It's April 22nd, and we have a public hearing on Senate Bill 5526, Oregon Health Authority, which are policy packages in the budget. Ms. Ames, would you start us off?
Madam Chair, members of the subcommittee, so this is the first day of two where we'll discuss the various policy packages in OHA's budget. The presentation that's on OLIS is what we should get through today. There's a separate presentation tomorrow. And so we're going to go through things that are included in PEB and OEB's budget and then in public health. And before we start into public health, I'm going to give you a little 101 on how fee increases work, because they will be discussing a number of those in their section of the presentation.
Thank you. We're ready for you.
Okay. Co-chairs Nathanson and Bates, for the record, my name is Kathy Loratz. I'm the interim administrator for the Public Employees Benefit Board, PEB, and the Oregon Educators Benefit Board, OEB.
And for the record, my name is Ali Hassoun. I'm the PEB Director of Operations.
For the record, Chair Nathanson and Co-Chair Bates, my name is Tamara Brickman, and I am with the Chief Financial Office of the Department of Administrative Services.
Thanks so much for having us. So today we're going to talk about a few policy option packages from both OEB and PEB. The first one is Policy Package 409. This is for OEB. Currently, OEB has an informed enrollment tool that they have attached to their online insurance enrollment tool that all members use when they enroll for the benefits during open enrollment. This has been available as a pilot project in conjunction with a research project out of MIT. Yeah, this package would allow this program to continue to be offered not only during open enrollment but throughout the year, which would benefit people who were thinking ahead for the next open enrollment. They had maybe mid-year changes like the addition of a child, or new employees would also have access to that. The policy package is about 4% of the total PEB operating budget, and I guess it's $450,000 other funds. Anybody have any questions on that one?
You can just keep going.
Okay.
I'll come back to it.
We'll interrupt.
All right. The second one is Policy Package 091, and this also is an OEB package. House Bill 2279 that was enacted in the 2013 legislative session allowed cities, counties, and other municipalities to join either PEB or OEB. Along with that was the addition of board members onto either the PEB or the OEB board, depending on who joined where. The first part of this package is for $1,400 to help cover the per diem for board members as they come on board. There will be a board member on the OEB board currently that represents management, and then one that represents labor from the other municipalities. The second is a new position actually for OEB, and this is also tied to House Bill 2279. This would be a program position that would be dedicated to helping PEB and OEB with education and onboarding of new groups as they come forward. Currently, we have the position would be shared by PEB and OEB, but it would be under OEB's budget and not under PEB's. And that is for $286,000 for the biennium. The next item is related to Oregon's initiative on the healthiest state. PEB and OEB are moving forward to become involved in that. During our other presentation, I believe there was just some further interest on this. There's no money attached. Currently, PEB and OEB have about 6% of the Oregon population enrolled in our benefits. In some areas, it's even higher than that. Klamath Falls, I think it's quite a bit higher than that because of just the makeup of the population down there. This initiative is a private public initiative, and it is aimed at communities in improving the grocery stores, restaurants, parks, other infrastructure like streets to improve the overall health of a community. And since we are in just about every community, any improvement in the health in any community would also improve our members and hopefully lead to lower cost. So we are involved in that. Have also made a contribution from PEB for $1 million towards the cause. And then the last one is the PEB policy package 091. We will use the additional funds to improve and maintain our online enrollment program called PEB.Benefits. We are looking to move the administration of retirees and self-insurance, the collection of their premiums in-house. We currently use an outside vendor, but we'd like to bring that in-house. And also to bring in the administration of the gym subsidy program. We use an outside vendor for that. And then also for the onboarding of the new groups through 2279. So bringing in-house the administration of the retirees, semi-independents, self-pays, and also the gym subsidy will save money because we can do it less expensively than a vendor, but it also would give us some flexibility in the administration of particularly the gym subsidy program.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You know, it occurs to me to wonder, hearing you talk about retiree stuff, are you referring? I've been having some conversations with Mr. Redman at PERS, well, actually, previously with his predecessor, Mr. Clary. But they have this program where if there are retirees who are under the age of benefit from Medicare, they help them buy health insurance. It's not a huge number of people; it's about 1,500 people, but it seems expensive, and we've been asking them to figure out a way to get out of that business because it doesn't seem they're not really a health insurance provider. So are you talking about potentially bringing that over to your shop? And if not, is that something you guys could do if we gave you statutory authority to do it? I mean, you're already buying health insurance for people. I don't see why we couldn't have you do it for retirees, too, who are below Medicare age.
Co-chairs Nathanson and Bates and Senator Steiner Hayward. We are talking about PEB-specific retirees pre-65-year
right.
old.
Right.
And in the PERS programs, there's people that are not PEB-specific. There's other PERS counties and things
right.
like that.
Right, okay.
We could probably do that. Currently, we pool our retirees with our working active employees, so I don't know that would have a significant effect on our rates if we were to do that.
No. I'm sorry, Madam Chair. Quick follow-up on me. Thank you. I wasn't saying worrying about your rates. I was worrying about, but so you think that most of the people that PERS is providing that benefit to are non-PEB PERS beneficiaries, mm-hmm. not PEB PERS beneficiaries.
Co-chairs Nathanson, Bates, and Senator Steiner Hayward. No, I can't say that.
Okay.
But I do
we
know
can
there,
talk about it.
Yeah, it is a mixture, and the state does have a stipend for early retirees. I don't know.
Okay.
It has to do with. But yeah, we could talk about that later. But
we'll figure it out.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Representative Boone, then Senator Bates.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Some time ago, we talked about finding out if you would consider people who bought their own gym equipment who not belonging to a gym, but they live in the rural areas and it's just not reasonable to drive half an hour to an hour each way to go to a gym. But they are willing to invest in equipment for a home-based gym. And so I just wondered where that was at, and would you consider adding that in as a one of these benefits for the PEB members?
Co-chairs Nathanson, Bates, and Representative Boone. This bringing in-house administration of that would give us the flexibility to do that, and we would be more than willing to take that forward to the board and see if they want to add that as an expansion to the gym subsidy program.
Okay, thank you. Because I think there are a lot of people who mm-hmm. would benefit from that. Thank you.
Senator Bates.
Thank you. A couple of issues here. first we have to understand that PEB and OEB, in comparison to what taxpayers get for health insurance, is an incredibly rich program and incredibly expensive to the state. So let's start right there. We are going to be subject, apparently, to a tax by the federal government on PEB in the coming years due to the fact that it's considered a Cadillac system. I'd like to hear your comment on what you think that tax might be and how we have to adjust the program to avoid the tax.
Co-Chairs Nathanson and Bates, the excise tax is set through the ACA to come into effect in 2018, and it does have a tax associated with benefits that have annual premiums above a certain limit, both for employee only and for employee and family. Currently, PEB, it would apply to both PEB and OEB, not just PEB. But currently in the PEB program, the family tier is under the maximum allowed, and the employee is over the max. So we have been talking with the board, and we are working towards a plan where we will phase in some changes in the way that we tier our plans, the way that the comparison between employee only, employee and spouse, and employee and family, so that we can smooth that out. And by 2018, we will be in a position where we will not be paying the tax. And OEB is also working on a plan to do the same.
Follow up?
Yes.
I'd like to see the specifics of that plan, and I don't want to just be looking at it from the point of view of we're to tier it so we avoid the tax. We have to have a serious conversation of what PEB and OEB are costing the state, especially when looking at how much money we're putting into K-12 that doesn't get to the classroom because of these programs. OEB is a different animal. I'd like to hear more about that, too, because it's so varied across different entities, whether it be county, city, various school districts, and getting some uniformity in that and moving to a larger base of people should bring your cost down. The question here is, what do you expect your premium per member cost to do in the next 2 years?
Co-chairs Nathanson and Bates, we are currently capped at 3.4% increase, and we are all working to keep underneath that cap as we go forward. We're both PEB and OEB are working on their 2016 renewals, and so we will be staying underneath that cap.
We'll follow up.
Yes.
Now, I'd like to see some numbers on that. I'd like to see the cap actually lowered. Most plans are going to 1% or less. The Oregon Health Plan is going to a minus 1%. It's huge amounts of money flowing through these programs. There's very little participation sometimes with the employees, but not always. It varies. We need to look at these numbers very carefully. If we want to put more money in the classrooms, we're going to have to deal with some of these issues.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Certainly.
Continue. Next slide. Are you done?
Yes.
Ms. Ames, go ahead and while we're making the transition, provide us with some context and overview here.
Madam Chair, members of the subcommittee, public health has a number of packages they're going to talk about besides fees, but at the end there's some detailed discussion about fees. So there's really three different scenarios where fees get increased, and it isn't just public health, but in the state system. One is a fee that was increased administratively through Department of Administrative Services during the interim, and now it's being ratified by the legislature so that it can continue on. So they do have a couple fees that fit that category. And in fact, if you remember when we did public hearings, we posted Senate Bill 5527, which is that ratification bill, which when we work their budget, we'll work that bill as well. The second thing is that there were some new fees included in the governor's budget, and the radiation-related fees. And in that particular case, that program has a statutory fee cap. Not all fees do. Many fees allow them to be set administratively, but that has a So a bill is going through the legislature, Senate Bill 228, I think, is to allow that cap to be increased. And then in their budget, they're increasing some of those fees, not necessarily to the cap. The idea is that the cap will be high enough to accommodate some increases over several years. So, and then third, in the last couple of months, the agency has made a lot of effort to go through all their fee-based programs and really look at where they're at in terms of budget and fee levels, and have identified several other areas where they believe they will need a fee increase. We're trying to get agencies out of the routine of waiting till the middle of the biennium when we're in the interim and realizing, oh my God, we need a fee increase because we're not going to make it through the biennium, and then using the administrative process to raise those fees. So we're trying to get into a routine where we look ahead, and if we think they need fee increases during the next biennium, we do it now during their budget. So they're going to talk about all three categories. And, of course, during work session, we'll go back through this all, but I thought it might be helpful to start out with that context.
Okay.
So you want us to just, Linda, you want us to just identify them as 1, 2, and 3? You'll remember that now.
Okay.
Just trying to help Bill out there.
Go ahead. Thank you. For the record, I'm Lillian Shirley, the Public Health Director. Representative Nathanson, co-chair, Senator Bates, co-chair, really thank you very much for allowing us this time before you. The first item that we're going to talk about in the governor's budget is the money that would be used to get ready to implement the restructuring of the Oregon system for public health. And we talked at our presentation about House Bill 3100 and what the implications would be for the whole system. This request is to really do the work that is necessary in the interim between this session and the passing of the bill to the next session, so that we can be prepared to implement and bring the plan back to all of you and to the whole legislature for approval. The tasks that this would entail are outlined on the slide here, and the investment will be used to build the framework for implementation for this local and state system to go forward. The public health preparedness section, which is a really core and crucial function of the public health department, the governor's budget includes $1 million investment for operational readiness to prepare, respond, and mitigate public health disasters. And the bullet points here outline where we've identified gaps across the state, as well as places where we can work with local communities to shore up those requirements of readiness, both preparing and responding, and to mitigate public health disasters. Public health is present in every emergency that impacts human health, even when we're not the first agency responder. And we talked a little bit about some of the studies we've done with wildland fires. Certainly we are not in charge of wildland fires, but we want to make sure that their implications with human health is tracked and assessed and evaluated with the local health departments on the ground. The Oregon Patient Safety Commission in the governor's budget includes an additional $500,000 investment in the early discussion and resolution area created by Senate Bill 483 in 2013. This was an innovation that Oregon put in place. It's a bit of a model across the nation to improve patient safety and to reduce medical liability across the system cost. So this money, this investment would be to continue that work and to enhance that work with more materials, website development, and basically education and outreach to both the provider community and to consumers to understand what their options are and how these components can work
There's the filing, the discussing, and the resolving to avoid unnecessary confrontation between providers and consumers.
Madam Chair.
Yes.
Thank you. What's your total budget for this?
Total budget for this?
Senator Bates, Chair Nathanson, members of the committee, the total budget presently is $1.6 million, and it's entirely a pass-through straight to the Patient Safety Commission.
And the follow-up?
Yes.
That general fund dollars?
That is correct.
And how many cases have been processed so far?
I'll get back to you on that. I'll have to check with the administrator for the Patient Safety Commission.
Follow-up?
Yes.
Have any cases been processed so far?
I don't know the answer to that question.
Mr. Chair. Madam Chair, if I may, my understanding from talking to, I don't even remember who, within the past week, that there have been 32 cases that are in process at the moment, but I would want to confirm that with somebody. But I've heard that, but I asked mm-hmm. about it because I'm supposed to be on the Patient Safety Committee Commission oversight for this process, and I have not heard Ward 1 about any meetings of that yet.
Okay.
So I have my share of concerns as well.
Last question, and
yes.
We've got a meeting out in the hall real quick.
Yes.
Thank you. Also, I'd like to know if you can, and this may be a difficult question, what impact has had on tort claims in the state of Oregon?
I think we can get back to you on that. I think that it's a follow-up from the first, how many people have actually utilized it.
But it's also, what's follow-up?
Yes.
What's happened in the whole world here? I mean, as far as the state of Oregon is concerned, is this program really starting to work? Is it not working? And I would suggest if you talk to the malpractice insurers, they probably give you a pretty good idea of what's happened. Mm-hmm. And the commission may have already done that. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator. Moving into the fee area, the x-ray tanning and our fee limits, this is one of those categories where we talked about the licensing has a statutory fee cap, as the LFO staff has identified. And what we're asking for here is that we could increase the materials and the cap. It'll maintain the equitable structure, so we won't be subsidizing the customer service that we do for this work through other areas. General fund. So I don't know if there's any specific questions on that. I think it's one of the important points is that this was last raised in 2007. Radioactive. That's all I have next. Okay. I'm sorry. I had another slide next. So. Representative Nathanson and members of the committee, the radioactive materials licensing fee, basically this is something that we're looking forward to. The industry is our customers, and we're asking that if we can continue to increase the licensing fees. The program is kind of common sense, you know, that you want to make sure that the machines that people are using meet standards, or haven't deteriorated, that the people who are using those machines are sufficiently trained. If it's not approved, then it'd be necessary to reduce the staff, but also back to the customer piece of it, people who have businesses, you know, expect us to be able to respond in a timely manner to be able to do that.
Madam Chair?
Yes. That's the request.
I'm sorry, Ms. Shirley, can you explain why is there a sunset on a licensing fee?
Before my time.
Chair Nathanson, Senator Steinmeier Hayward, excuse me, the sunset on this particular policy option package really relates to the Senate Bill 333 process that LFO staff was articulating earlier. So this particular fee has been administratively adjusted during the interim, but this will sunset back to its former fee level by June 30th if it's not ratified.
I see. So,
right.
Okay. So if we ratify it now, then it's permanently done like this, and we're okay. It's not like other fee increases that have to be done in separate
bills,
Madam
like for
Chair,
other licensing Senator. Fees.
Madam Chair, Senator Steiner Hayward, that is correct.
I understand. I apologize for my confusion. Thank you.
No apology necessary.
Yeah. Madam Chair and Senator Steiner Hayward, this is part of our trying to look at how to make it more rational and simplify our fees going forward and get everything into an alignment process.
Okay, thank you.
Now we're back to sit. Okay. Madam Chair and members of the committee, this is to add this next increase, this next request is that we have, according to ORS 433, we've added to our panel once we had the technology to be able to do it. It's another example of Senate Bill 333. We are doing this test, but we didn't have, it's an additional test. Now we have the chemical reactors to be able to work on this. This is something that's only been around for about 4 or 5 years. It increases the likelihood of children surviving. It's very important that the babies get the diagnosis within the first few months of life. And the severe combined immunodeficiency disease that some children are born with is 100% fatal. So the intervention has to happen right away. The last fee increase for the newborn screening panel was in October of 2002, so this screening was not included in it at that point. The policy option package laboratory accreditation testing is basically to enable the state public health lab to fulfill its additional requirements after the passage of Measure 91. We have some responsibilities to continue to accredit new labs that come online specifically to serve the public with marijuana product. So this money would allow us to include, it's based on our existing fee schedule, it's not anything, you know, out of the ordinary, but it reflects the additional workload and the need for positions to begin that work once the Measure 91 is implemented. And another kind of fine point on this is the OLCC cannot issue the licenses for these labs until someone accredits those labs. So we would be up front accrediting the lab, and then they can apply to the OLCC for a license. So, Madam Chair, members of the committee, getting coaching from our budget director, back to the explanation in the beginning of the three categories. This is an example, the vital records fees, of that third category of fees that come up. The Center for Health Statistics is requesting approval to increase their fees for services. Now, they've had a decline in revenue, and they've also had additional costs that have gone up over the years. The last time the fee was raised was in December of 2003. So our operations cost and our personnel costs have increased significantly over that time. We would think that members of the general public, again, this is another issue where our customers are the general public. The need for these records are obvious in terms of people need them for their driver's license, people need them for identity, people need them to get Social Security cards. But also, it helps a number of the counties with their revenue, too, because there are a number of counties where they have direct, you can go to the local county health departments and county administrative offices around the state. So it will help the counties as well as the state for this service.
Yes, Representative Byrne.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Is that the there are county fees in addition to this fee increase?
Yeah, no, they have the same schedule. So this would allow for this particular product, if you will, would be across the state, would have the same schedule. So drinking water service fees. This is a totally fee-supported program, as you know, and there's really four components that are impacted by this, which is how to certify the operators of the public water systems, certify backflow device testers and specialists to ensure that there's competence in those two areas for the personnel, and review plans for modifications of public water system facilities and ensure that there are health-based construction standards are met when you are beginning a new water system facility, and also to inspect water systems to identify and correct public health hazards that arise. So,
Representative Boone. Yeah. I don't know if this is a good place to insert, but yesterday or the day before in committee in environment and water or environment and energy, we talked about fees that or policy that will take out inspections of water system for rentals, and just wondered if you wanted to comment on that. And this is in, I guess they're going to put in some sort of education outreach or whatever, but has your shop met with that yet?
I'm unfamiliar. Huh?
Okay.
I do have a subject matter expert here. I could ask
I would like Ms. Ames to respond.
Madam Chair, members of the subcommittee, I don't remember the bill number, but it has to do with private wells. Mm-hmm. And you have a small federal grant where there's some testing of private wells and some outreach. I think that bill was trying to expand it to include landlords testing their
water. But they took it out, and one of the reasons was, and especially in the rural areas, some of the houses rent for just a few $100s, and the owners, the landlords, don't have the money to start getting into wells and septics and all that and seeing if it's safe. So I just wondered if there is a grant that would provide for that for people who need it. But it just, I guess I just thought it was kind of going backwards in a sense.
Mm-hmm. Based on the fiscal information that we worked with the agency on, the trouble is the federal grant's very small. It ends in September, and so they have limited resources in that particular area. These fees tend to apply to, you know, bigger water systems.
Right, and so I guess the final comment on it is, and nobody knew yesterday, but what is the, is it sort of a complaint-driven system? So say somebody rents a house out in the country and they start getting sick or whatever, or their water tastes terrible and they can't use it, and they find something really bad with it and whatever. And so is there a process that people, or a place they can go if the landlord isn't going to do it?
Yeah. Yes, I would like to ask Dave Leland to come up and answer that. Our scope it doesn't include private wells, so this is for public systems.
Right. But is there an intersection
with human health, then our communicable disease program can respond.
So your shop is the right place to go.
Yeah. It's not the drinking water program, but if there was a impact on human health that needed to be investigated, we would do that. Not under regulatory, you know, areas, but under protection. Yeah, protecting the public. Yeah.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you.
Okay. Oh, and just one other point. The last time these fees were raised was 1994, 2006, and then 2008, respectively, in like different categories. Okay.
So I think that's it.
So the lead-based paint program fees, basically this is a result of significant decreases in federal funding, as well as increasing concern on the part of Oregonians around the impact of lead in the environment on health, particularly health of children. So this fee would would make it so that the program can continue, and that the current fees would, if approved, then the fees that we are able to charge for this certification and testing for lead inspection and mitigation would also be able to, we could go from a 1-year to a 3-year certification process. And that would make it less onerous on the operators as well. But,
This is a can of worms, this lead-based paint issue. And I have constituents who've been dinged on it and before and went ahead and got the training, but it's kind of odd. I know the feds run it, but you do it. But the thing that seems odd to me is if someone touches a house, basically, that has been built before a certain date, you're required to have this certification. Whether or not you're going to be cutting into it or not, I mean, that's how deep it goes. And I just wonder if you must work with building codes and
yes,
that agency, yeah, but yeah. It just seems like there's a huge thing here that should be fixed.
Well, the federal guidance comes from the EPA, and those are the regulations and laws that we line up this program with.
Right.
But most of the initial activity around protection from lead paint came from the EPA, and that's what we have to mirror locally.
And follow up?
Yes.
Are you the ones who train the people who go out and bust people for these violations?
So we...
It seems very disconnected from what I am hearing in the field.
Correct. Yeah. No, it is. It's. I would say it's complex. I don't know if disconnected is the term, but it's definitely a complex series of regulations, rules that mm-hmm. overlapping jurisdictions, trying to bring it into alignment.
Good.
And we are looking very carefully at the program and how to better align it, and look at making it easier to understand, not only for the consumers and the residents and the housing, or the people who have to worry about this in the playground, but also for the homeowners and the property owners as well.
Yeah. Final follow-up. Yeah. I guess my comment would be, I would be much more settled if I knew that whoever is going out and investigating has the same set of rules, because it seems to depend on who you get and what county you're in and what you're doing. It's mm-hmm. whatever that person believes is the case. And that's just not fair, So,
yeah. No, it's
if you do something about that, that would make me happy.
Well, it definitely warrants, a real process improvement project. I will get back to you on that, Representative
okay.
Boone.
All right, thanks.
Madam Chair, if I may, thank you so much. But if I may, I would point out that this is true of almost any inspection program in the state. I mean, I happen to know about this because it doesn't matter whether it's related to public health or buildings or pretty much anything. Building code is building code. I mean, some counties have slightly different things than others, but there's some state rules about that, and you'll know that you'll find inspectors who enforce those things or deal with them differently. And I happen to know about this because I was the camp doctor at a day camp for years, and we'd get the camp inspectors in from the county public health folks, and it really depended a lot. And some counties were known for being more easygoing than others, and some inspectors were known for being harder than others. And it's a personality issue and a training issue, even though the rules statewide are the same. It's hard to control. I mean, I get your point, Representative Boone. I think you're correct about that. We have to make sure everybody's singing from the same sheet of music. But, it's tough to standardize.
Right, and it requires standardizing across different agencies with different missions. So, all of that adds to the complexity.
Thank you.
Any further questions, Madam Chair? No? Members of the committee.
I will add one thing, Madam Chair, members of the subcommittee. I think at the end of this, yes, if you go a couple more pages, is all the gory details of all these fee increases. And you can act, you know, when I first got my first fee increase, I thought if water fee was increasing, there would be one fee and it would go from 100 to 125. No water program has 50 fees, and that's pretty common of every program out there. And even if you think about a small little licensing board, there's new licenses, there's annual renewal licenses, there's, you know, it's always more complicated than you think. But you can see here the magnitude of the increases, for instance. And when we come back to do the final budget look, I'll have more information for you about sort of what the typical increases are, how much revenue it's generating compared to the total revenue it already generates, and some of those kind of details.
Mm-hmm. Any other questions? Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee.
James, that concludes our work for today. Is that correct? There's mm-hmm. nothing else on the agenda.
Correct.
Anything else for the committee?
Thank you. We're adjourned.
That does it.
I miss all the good stuff.
Fees.
Questions.
Fees.
I miss all the good stuff.